Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. We're here with famous advice columnist Amy Alkin to talk about how the normal person in the 21st century should act in various social situations. From parking spaces to Facebook friend requests, these days are a bit complicated. Amy will tell us how to act based upon her book, Good Manners for the Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck. This book isn't about which fork to use for your salad, but about the loud cell phone talker and noisy neighbor. The world is getting too big for our brains these days, and politeness might be a thing of the past, or not. Alkin has tips on how to deter rudeness by invoking people's evolved concern to protect their own reputation. Full of fun and insight, Alkin's book is a must-read, and we're happy to have her on our show. Amy, welcome.
Thank you.
One of the things that my producer wrote is that this book is written for nice people who say fuck. And that, I think, is just so brilliant because the concept of a curse, actually, from a Greek perspective, means to wish somebody harm. To say fuck is not a curse. It is simply a word that invokes, and so often invokes, a sense of bonding, trust, and the fact that you're just not uptight.
You're absolutely right. I love that you see it that way. And, you know, yeah, it's rude to say fuck if you're around somebody's elderly aunt or their four-year-old. People don't want that to be one of their kids' first words. But otherwise, you know, it's a really fun way to punctuate conversation. And actually, I put that in the beginning of my book, too, about why I use that word, because I wanted to show that this is a book about how to treat other people, and we don't care about where you put the silverware as long as you're not really rude to somebody while you're putting it there.
Now let's go into that. What does it mean? To be rude? Is it simply about being disassociating and not understanding a person's culture or their comfort level, or is there something more to it?
Well, really, at the root of manners is empathy, and rudeness is acting without empathy. And I like the German word Einfühlung, which is, I probably said that terribly, feeling in.
Actually, that was pretty good.
Thank you. It's feeling into what. How would you feel? How would I feel if you did that to me, actually? And to think about that before you're going to do something to someone, or on a positive note, to think about how something would positively affect someone else. So rudeness basically is not thinking of other people or thinking of them as tools that you can use.
You know. So let's start with this statement. In a very real sense, we are our brother's keeper, which simply means we do affect the people around us. You know, and that's what makes us. That's the difference between being a civilization and not. You know, and all this extremism where people simply see themselves as better or separate. And they're able to, I love when you said that rudeness is a form of theft. It really is. It's a form of theft. Go into that more for me, Amy.
Okay, well, I have to backtrack a little bit to tell your audience why people are rude. And I figured this out based on anthropology research by a British anthropologist, Robin Dunbar, who measured the human neocortex, the brain's reasoning and judgment center, and he figured out that we have a capacity for about 150 relationships. That's where you know them, they know you, you owe them, they owe you. And so we evolved in these small bands like this. And then, so even if you were a big old jerk, you couldn't act like a jerk because you would have been thrown out of the band in a day when there was no couch surfing, there were no 7-Elevens. You probably would have died. And so we really don't have a capacity for dealing with strangers because we didn't evolve to know strangers. And so my theory is that we're rude because we live in societies that are now too big for our brains. We have these Stone Age brains, and we are living amongst strangers. And that's why somebody flips you the bird, you know, after they're driving out of Starbucks, because they'll never see you again, and it doesn't matter.
And you know what? You're 100% correct. And the truth of the matter is, you go to small towns, people are not rude. And even though I live in the city, I live on 86th street in Madison. I have a home in Connecticut as well for the weekends, and I can't believe, like, when I forget to go on green, people won't beep. Like, they'll wait for me to figure it out and then go. In New York City, they beep the second it turns green. And you're right. When there's more people, then people do get depersonalized. And very often, and what you said, I think is actually brilliant, is we have not caught up with our genetics.
Yeah. Or really, the thing is that we have these very antique brains, and they haven't caught up with our times. So, and this is why, you know, we have this evolved lust for sugar, because it would have made sense when we were all running around in loincloths, if there was a berry on a bush, you never knew where your next berry was coming from. You didn't drag around a refrigerator with you. So eat that berry now. And so now, you know, you can get a pallet load of Twinkies at one of these warehouse stores. I know you have to drive to New Jersey. I used to live in New York, near the rectum to New Jersey, the tunnel on Canal Street. But, you can get so much food now that it's just a problem evolutionarily that we have this adaptation to be all, yay, sugar.
Well, again, it's interesting because sugar itself, what happens is it creates a tremendous amount of anxiety and depression. But you're right. What happens is that children are programmed for both sugar and salt, and particularly sugar, and they will keep eating it. If they're not exposed to it early in life, they don't desire it, because I don't like sugar, and I wasn't exposed to it. So
that's because you're a man. All girls like chocolate.
All girls do. I'm sure. You know what? I never met a girl who didn't like chocolate.
I haven't either. I mean, this isn't a scientific study, but if I met a woman who didn't like chocolate, I would be shocked.
So I want your take on something that you wrote. What is your definition of positive shaming? Okay, and give me an example of where you would use it.
Okay, again, there I have to backtrack a little bit. So we are all human. I didn't write this book because I have perfect manners. I can sometimes be rude, but I try to look at my behavior and say, oh my God, I was such a jerk. I need to not do that again, and try to pre-plan to be better. So people like that, you know, people you encounter who are on their phones because they just aren't mindful that they're bothering you, these are not the people we need to shame. You say something to them in a nice way, you're not really mean to them. They will say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize, blah, blah, blah. But for people who are egregiously rude, because we now live in these societies too big for our brains, we're around strangers, there are no constraints on their behavior anymore. And so what I like to say is there's a new sheriff in town, and it's the YouTube video gone viral. So we need to clandestinely, so you won't get hurt, shoot the video of people doing egregiously rude things, the person not picking up after their dog, they're looking up in a tree because, like, oh, there's a movie up there, you know, so they're not noticing their dog's pooping, leaving, you know, a turd the size of a Great Dane, you know, right, in front of your house. And so those people need to be shamed. Now, we don't know that they will actually see the video on YouTube. They might if it goes viral and ends up in the New York Times, as some do. I put one of those dog crap booby trap in my book. This great guy, Steve Miller in Florida, had a video camera, caught the guy who threw poop in his bushes every day. But what it will do is affect other people who are also jerks. They will not become better people, but they will see that video and think, uh-oh, I could get caught. And so this deters their bad behavior.
Right. So what you're saying is that the fear deters it. Now, what happens, though, if we lighten that up and rather than shaming them, I'm curious that you pull out of your pocket, because I live across the street from Central Park and I see that all the time, and I pull out an extra bag and say, you know what, you must have run out of bags. Why don't you use this?
Okay, that is lovely.
Okay, so that works as well.
Well, that's a great solution. Here's why. You are doing, I call this a matter-of-fact solution, and I can explain it in the context of my neighborhood. I now live in Venice. I live right close to the street, and people come in a convertible with a fabulous sound system, and they will boom, 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 play music, and I can feel it in my soul, if we have a soul, in my spine, my soul. And so what I want to do is go out, and when I'm angry, I'm funnier, and say something really cutting to them, but instead I go out and I say, don't say, hey, turn off your music. That's controlling them. That will make them defensive. I say, hey, excuse me, you probably didn't notice, but we're really close to the property line here, and we hear everything inside. This is like what you're doing with the bag. you're saying to somebody, you're not a rude person, you just didn't have a bag. And the people want to say, they want to confirm, no, I'm not a rude person. And so they tend to turn down their music, and I bet they tend to take your bag, thank you, and pick up after their big poopy dog.
And absolutely. More likely they take the bag and they wait till I leave and don't. But sometimes they will take the bag, and if I just stare there until they pick it up, they'll do that. You know, mm-hmm. So and I have been guilty of walking my dog early in the morning and forgetting my bags, and it's hard to find the person with a bag there. But the thing that gets me in terms of pet peeves, and I'm you know, my wife kidded around because I told her this morning while we were talking about etiquette, and she said, "You're talking about etiquette. You eat with your fingers, okay? I mean, I don't use almost everything. I eat with my fingers. There's more food on me at the end of the meal than there is on the plate. But at the end of the day, the one pet peeve I have is when I'm going to a real nice restaurant and the people." Who are, you know, relatively not, you know, they're not that close. They're so loud. They're so loud that I can't enjoy the dinner. And I realize that alcohol does turn up the volume, you know, and my wife's on the shy side and I'm on the outrageous side. And I want to simply want to say to them, listen, you guys have amazing energy, but if you tone it down, I'm going to have more fun. Okay. And if not, I'm going to eat everything on your plate. And I'll pick up something on their plate and put it in my mouth. I mean, I'll do something, you know, that makes it a little bit more fun. How would you approach someone? You're spending $300 on this dinner, you're with your significant other, and the person next to you or the couple next to you is just so loud you can't enjoy it.
Well, let me ask you, are you saying that you actually approach them or are you joking about approaching them?
Oh, no, I approach him. I don't know.
Okay, but you're very wise, I can tell from talking to you, and you're a psychologist. You have all this knowledge about how to do that and not be impulsive and just haul off at people. Many people are not that extroverted. They're not able to do that. And the thing to know is that basically your diplomatic emissary in the restaurant is the manager. So his ultimate job is acting as the guardian of customers' pleasant dining experiences. So this is the thing to do if people are loud, if their child is being horrible at running a car across your mashed potatoes, or, for example, if you get bad food. People wait, they sit there in the restaurant, miserable, festering with anger about their food, and they wait until they go home and put up the bad Yelp review to do anything about this. Instead, the manager, he knows you're going to do that. He wants to stop that. He wants to make your experience pleasant. So if your intent is not to get somebody, but to get a good meal, to get what you paid for, talk to the manager.
I mean, sometimes, to be honest with you, in the city that works, very often they would say, listen, they're here for a good time just like you. See, what I find what works, Amy, is I go up to the table and I'll take a French fry, and they'll say, what the hell are you doing? And I'll say, does that bother you? And they say, yeah, it bothers you. So does your loud voice. So I won't eat your food, and you'll talk quiet, you know?
See, that's dangerous. You know, people could clock you. You never know who's armed, you know? And so,
it's usually me, but I've been doing that forever. It actually, if as long as it's playful, and see, that's the idea. People think that they have to get angry. And when you get angry, you're really out of control. Most people, down deep inside, they do want to do the right thing. But sometimes, again, when it mixes with alcohol, you know, when they're having a good time, and you want to say, listen, I want you to have a good time, but I don't want you to have it, you know, at my expense, nor vice versa. And you always get crazies. I mean, you always get someone, you know, who might get crazy, but you're right, meaning because I'm doing this for 40 years, I'll deal with the crazy in a different way.
Right. See, but you're a professional. And so what I do in this book is I give advice for the rest of us, basically, and it is based in science. It's all behavioral science based, even on discuss theory, on what you can and can't do at the dinner table, what behaviors. So it's not like I'm, you know, a stranger to the science, but I recognize that I am what's called a costly punisher, meaning that I see injustice and I get on my broom at cost to me, and there's no benefit. Nobody's going to give me a lottery ticket that wins because I told somebody in this pharmacy line we needed them be quiet. But most people are not that. Most people are afraid of confrontation, worried about what would happen. And so that's why I don't give advice like that. If I were talking to an audience only of you, I would give that advice because you can do it.
Right. Well, correct. And it is, it's not, again, it's not for everyone. But the realization and what you said earlier on is, I think, the most profound thing, is that when you lose your empathy for another human being, you yourself become less human. You know, and empathy is not just understanding, it's feeling what they feel. Correct. You know, so it's, you know, I think that's really great advice. So what would you do if you see a guy who's on his cell phone and you're in a place where you can't, maybe a bus or a train, and he's really loud? How would you get him to kind of quiet down?
Well, actually, instead of telling him to get off his phone, first of all, I can tell you why he's rude based on the science he's quiet. But to just ask him, would you mind keeping it down a little bit? So you're not telling him what to do, because people don't like to be controlled. You're not criticizing him. Because criticism, people think this makes people change. You criticize them, they'll change. No, it makes them want to clobber you. So that's your best shot. It's often actually not successful. They say, well, why don't I have a right to talk the same as the other people on the bus? And research finds it's the most amazing thing that a one-sided conversation like that on a cell phone or of a crazy person, I want to be expansive here, that is more interruptive to the brain than a two-sided conversation, because our brain seems compelled to figure out the other side. This is something that's automatic. We can't stop this from happening. And this is why even those cell phone calls of people trying to be quiet are actually rude and cause what I call neural itching.
Neuro itching. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. And how do you scratch neuro itching?
You shut the person up by hitting them over the head with a frying pan. No, that's our impulse, because it's very bothersome to the brain. You know, your brain is being, basically your brain's being hijacked by somebody's inane conversation. And nobody is ever giving out great stock tips or gossip about Anna Wintour or anything. It's all this inane stuff. And you never have anybody in the grocery store line say, hey, anybody not want to hear that my colleague's bullshit problem with their boss? It's just they just force it on you. And that's what's rude. And forcing anything on other people, you don't have a right to force your conversation into somebody else's brain.
You know, sometimes people don't even know what they're doing. Like, what happens is, I've learned this when I live, because I moved to the country on the weekends, that if you burn wood that has not been dried for a year, you burn wood that's still wet, it actually emits a toxin that is dangerous to both dogs and humans and can get them extremely ill. And I didn't know that, but I found out, through research. If you were going to a neighbor to let them know that it would be better for them to burn dry wood, tell me how you would approach it.
Okay, this is really important. Face to face, we are impulsive jerks. You probably know about Kahneman, and I'm sure you do, Kahneman and Tversky's research on our fast and slow modes of thinking. So our fast mode of thinking is our emotional, impulsive system. It's right in there to clobber somebody for their behavior. Our rational system, that's our slow system, is slower to awaken, and you've already done the thing that's got you into jail. And your rational system's thinking, maybe that wasn't a good idea. And so, excuse me, because of that, what we need to do is to pre-plan our behavior. And so instead of talking to someone, actually what's much better is to write a note, not an email, because it's very easy to haul off and be impulsive in an email, but a note that you put on a piece of paper and give to them, telling them, you probably don't know this. I just learned it recently. Always good to be humble. But this burning wet wood leaves these toxins. And you might even put in an article from some reputable publication, not one where the people wear the tinfoil hats, to let them know. And really emphasize that I learned this recently and stopped doing it myself. You know, just wanted to let you know, don't ask them to do anything. People don't like to be controlled. Even a whiff of control is bad. And this will just leave it in their hands. Oh, okay. And then if they don't do anything, You could talk to them. And then there are laws against doing certain things, you know, noise laws. We just had a dance party. I live in Venice. Somebody scheduled a dance party right by houses at 6:30 to 8:30 in the morning. Hi, we're sleeping. So there are noise laws to protect us, and there are probably laws that protect you too. But I try not to go to laws. I don't particularly like big government, but those laws are written so you won't be abused.
No, I don't like big government either, but I have to ask you this because you mentioned Venice. I've been to Venice a few times, love it. The shopping is the best in the world. But I don't get how you built a city in the middle of the water on floats. What was that all about?
Oh, you know, I'm talking Venice, California, right?
Oh, Venice, California. Okay.
I'm not in Venice.
You needed to make that little distinction.
Sorry. Okay. No, they don't have dance parties at 6:30 to 8:30 in the morning.
I was
going to
ask, what's the story, girl? Okay, good.
Those Italians, they're smart. No, this is right off Abbot Kinney, right near a neighborhood. All my neighbors come up, I'm like, why is there this? It was like a booming beat at 6:30 in the morning.
Now, I one advice that I would probably give to everyone, and that is you need to know your own level of communication and your own skill set in being able to gently manipulate a person, and manipulate simply means to position a person so that they'll be more willing to hear wisdom. So if you don't have that skill set, it is better to leave a note. If you have that skill set, people are very responsive, you know, to automatic intimacy, you know, where you know who you could touch and who you can't touch, simply because of sometimes just cultural. I was raised a liberal Jew. If you came to my house, you get kissed by everyone, including the dog. It's just the way it's done, kissed and fed, you know. And different cultures are different, but I like the idea of assessing. How is this person going to, the end result is you want a solution. So how is this person going to listen to what I have to say so that it makes sense to them and they don't become reactive? And that takes a little bit of thinking. And it does take the frontal lobe, the rational side of the brain, not the emotional side that just wants your own way. And that was, I think, a really good insight. In a nutshell, you really need to know your own skill set when you approach a person because people like the one-on-one approach, especially if you're not lecturing or threatening or making them feel bad so they're going to be reactive. So if you don't have a skill set, then always be pleasant, because what happens in this day and age, and I really want you to comment on this, Amy, is you could destroy a person's reputation online. You could start a smear campaign against anyone, okay, for anything. And once it's online and once it's on Yelp, it's almost impossible to get off. And you pay these companies $50,000 to do it, and they still can't do it.
I just have to comment. I love that. As someone also raised a liberal Jew, I love that you said a smear campaign.
I knew you were going to catch that. Yes, it's a smear campaign, but it's a smear campaign for a liberal Jew. Thank you for catching that. I'm in the mood for a bagel, Amy. What can I tell you?
You know what's terrible about these is that people will say things, you know, all of our conversation is not meant to be captured for posterity. Not everybody is careful about every word they say, and they aren't. The people who are being hung for this stuff, like the woman who, she was on a plane to South Africa, and she said, made some joke to say that white people, many white people, don't really think about, you know, Africa and AIDS. It was meant to be like that, but it came off to people as some kind of jokey comment about white people don't get AIDS, yay. And it wasn't what she meant. And I mean, she lost everything. And so people need to remember something. I know you know, attributional bias. We give ourselves huge leeway for things we do. This is big in driving. Now that I live in Venice, I drive. I used to drive a bike in New York and roller skates. But so you'll be driving and you'll make some error. You know, you'll almost kill somebody changing lanes. And you did that because you were tired, you were confused. When they do that, oh my God, it's like they followed you from your house and like drove behind you for 10 miles just to fuck with you. You know, we attribute other people to them these motives, these terrible motives we don't do to ourselves. And so I think we need to look with compassion, both on the internet when people do stuff, to think about, okay, is this person really some, you know, horrible, you know, baby eating, you know, violence advocating person, or did they maybe just throw out a comment without thinking too much about it?
I think you're right. And I think the other thing we need to know is we need to be very careful about our own skill set. I had a client who came to me, his girlfriend came to me because he had an anger disorder. And this guy was a huge guy. He was a 6'7", 325-pound Ecuadorian of all, you wouldn't think they're that big. And he had a rage disorder. And, we worked together, and hypnosis works extremely quick. And after 6 weeks, he just thanked me. And then one day he shows up at my office. I work really late. I worked from 8 a.m. to midnight. And he's all bloodied and he's all upset. I said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, this guy I accidentally cut off. I was texting. I didn't see it. And he got out of the car and he cursed me. And I said to him, listen, I was wrong and I'm sorry." This guy never in his life said he's sorry. So he drove away. The guy followed him. He took out $1,000 and he threw it on the floor and said, "Listen, take this as my apology." The guy still didn't. He followed him. And what ended up happening is my client ended up beating him to death with almost to death with a baseball bat. Oh. because he just didn't, he just didn't get it that, sometimes you just need to take the apology.
Yeah, but see, that's why I sort of don't agree with you, and respectfully, on the idea that it's okay to just talk to anyone. I think you have to look at them and assess them, because
no, that's the whole point. You absolutely, and you're right. I'm not saying for the average person to do that. You need to have an assessment of your own skill set, and if you don't have that skill set, you shouldn't do it.
But see, other people sometimes, they are quick to fly off the handle. We have an amygdala reaction where it's just that's the whole thinking fast and slow thing, that you have this fast reaction and you decide that somebody is trying to get one over you on you, or they're accusing you of something. And so people can react in unpredictable and violent ways. And that's why I think that, you have to be prepared. I'm prepared when I say something to someone. I assess them first. I'm a fast runner. I'm prepared to run, because you have to really recognize, am I prepared to accept the consequences? What are the potential consequences here of taking action?
Yeah, you know what? And we're not really disagreeing, because the truth of the matter is what I'm basically saying is that you do need to assess. Unfortunately, that's what I do in neuroplasticity, is to get the rational brain to be dominant over the emotional brain and over the reptilian brain, where people just react. Okay. And if you can't do that, then you shouldn't even take the risk if there's going to be consequences. But if you see that at the end of the day, it's really the way in which you approach it. Okay, and it's the humility which you come out and you would say, listen, if you could do this for me, I'd really appreciate it. And people are not going to jump on you unless they feel attacked. Because, part of the primal brain is that it responds to pleasure and pain and fear. If you corner someone who's operating out of that part of the brain, they will attack you. But if they don't feel cornered, right, they won't.
Yeah, we don't really, our brain doesn't really know whether it's a verbal attack or an attack from a hungry tiger. So, it reacts sort of the same way. It's sort of like a cudgel. And so I wish that were different, but it's not. So we have to go with it.
What are some of the new etiquettes that are arising in the 21st century? What has changed from 40 years ago to now? And what will change in the next 10 to 20 years in the States?
Well, actually, what I like to see, etiquette I see as the picky-wicky rules of society. And I like to see that actually etiquette rules, the stuff of like, where do you put the fork and can you wear white on this day, that those things, people are starting to ignore them because those things don't really matter. What they come out of is the high society trying to keep out the low people. And so the wearing white, for example, that came out of Civil War times. There started to be new money people, and the old money people didn't like that. So they came up with these societal codes to keep them out. So if you were wearing white on a certain day, you didn't get the message from Muffy Snuffington or whatever. And so you were sort of laughed at and looked down on as new money. And so, we're not that kind of society in America. We don't want to be. We're a society where Oprah came up from nothing as, basically the empress of media. And I like that about our country. So those things are going down. And when you say etiquette, that's sort of a broad question. Can you give me a more narrow narrow base of that.
I mean, like social rules. Like, is it now much more common and comfortable for when if you're going on a date, you split the check?
Oh my God, that's such a mistake. Okay, here's why.
I don't mind if you pay for the whole thing. I mean, that never bothered me.
Okay, here's the thing. We have these evolved preferences. We have evolutionary psychology. It's very old. It hasn't changed because women got the pill in the 60s and women's lib and all that other stuff. So women overwhelmingly seek men who are providers because they were the ones who could get pregnant from a single sex act. David Buss and David Schmidt, two evolutionary psychologists, call this differing sexual strategies. Men, on the other hand, they could just have sex with a woman and walk away. No child support, no nothing. They didn't have those boards back in the Stone Age. And so men evolved to seek women who were the healthiest, fertile candidates to bear their child and to do it visually. And so what's healthy is what we consider female beauty. So youth, clear skin, long, shiny hair, and an hourglass figure, a figure that's hourglass rather than straight up and down. So, and those things meaningfully connect to fertility. It can be medically measured. They have been by a few other evolutionary psychologists. So it is really important that a man at least symbolically pays. Now, a woman, she should be getting to know you, not the limit on your Black Amex card on the first date. So I like first dates to be cheap, short, and local. Take somebody to happy hour. So you buy the girl, you know, the happy hour wine or whatever. That's not a big spending thing, but you symbolically showed her what women look to see psychologically, even if they're like, you know, really they've free jets themselves. They want to see that a man is generous and a provider. So do that in a symbolic way. And if you start going out, you know, the woman should start to open her wallet. She should, you know, you pay one check, she pays one check. That's just how people behave if they're not greedy and disgusting.
You know what? I actually agree with you, and I was really kidding. I think that the whole idea of paying is a ritual that is protective and is also kind of showing respect and like I appreciate your company. But I actually completely agree that as relationships go on, it should be two people rowing the boat these days, and not one person in a role of taker and the other in giver. So
people do this in different ways. My boyfriend, I'm 51, I just turned 51. My boyfriend's 60, he's going to be 63. And he's just from another time. And when I first tried to pay for him, he was horrified. And so he pays for the food. He just likes it that way. He's more comfortable with it. You know, I don't care. You know, but he saw that I was not looking for that. And also, you know, I take care of him in many ways. It's just that he buys food. So, you know, I'm there for him, and
you know what? It's really cultural, and the fact of the matter is, he's in his 60s, and that's the way in his mind he's taking care of you, and there's nothing wrong with that. It is different among kids going out in their 20s when they're both broke.
Right, and I had a film critic boyfriend, and I could tell he was poorer than I was, and so I would pay when I would work it. So if we go to a more expensive restaurant, and they were like cheap, bad restaurants, but that I would pay because I didn't want him to be suffering because we were going out. And so it's just, but you really need to look at people's motivation. I have something that's called the spill drink test. It's about how somebody reacts when you spill a drink on them. It says a lot about their character. You know, society is very easy now. We don't have a lot of tests of character. So I think that people should do these kinds of things, like don't spill a drink on your date, but go hiking. Do things that where the big stress is more than, you know, that they drop their napkin under the table at the fine French restaurant.
Let me ask you the question. You put something in your book, which I never actually heard before. What is pedestrian walk blocking?
Oh, this is so horrible. Oh, my God. This happened to me a lot in New York. People, it's like they hold hands across the sidewalk on Fifth Avenue, like 10 abreast, and you can't get through. You know, it's like, you know, people need to not take over the sidewalk like cows grazing. You know, if you want to look up at the building, stand to the side. Or if you're texting, oh, there's people texting while moving. I mean, it's really horrible. Actually, the late David Carr, who's a friend of mine, he was a media reporter at the New York Times, he actually started doing this thing where he would just walk right into somebody. And I have a solution for that. When people are doing this thing where they come right at you, and I got it from Rome before the days of cell phones, when people were in their cars on cell phones, the traffic wouldn't let me through. You can't cross the street there. They ignore the traffic laws. They think they're traffic suggestions. And so one of my friends who lives there said, well, just don't look at the cars and they will stop for you. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to die. But it worked. You don't look, if you don't make eye contact with people, if you're looking down or into a window, they will part for you. It's an amazing thing. I've tried it here in Paris. It works.
Well, since one guy did that and I actually hit him, but he was very good about it. He just kind of bounced up and then he bounced and said, what did you do? And I said, I'm sorry. And I got the one New Yorker who didn't know a lawyer. But what is interesting is that people are in different state of minds. And the ones who are holding hands, very often they're so much in their own head, they don't realize that you too have rights. And I think that you made those two most interesting points, that the larger the society, you know, my daughter at a very early age taught herself Chinese and was teaching in Nanjing University English at around 17 or 18. She's a really smart kid. And she was telling me that she would see accidents where children were hit by cars and no one would stop. They would just keep on hitting them, bouncing forth, because in Mexico City and in different parts of China, you know, life is just not that precious. Where when you go to a small town, people, you know, actually, you know, they'll stop, you know, if they see an elderly person walk the street, even though they have the right of way. So there is something to be said about smaller groups and growing into our brain, which we haven't really done that much.
Right. But I do have to say, I lived in New York for a lot of years, gave free advice in the street corner in Soho. And in defense of New Yorkers, you know, I mean, I met some incredibly kind people who looked out for other people. I just saw countless examples of this. So not everybody is that.
Oh, I so agree. I am a native New Yorker, live here, you know, my whole life. And I do think, I'm going to go on record to say this, New Yorkers are really the nicest people in the world. They really will go out of their way to help you, particularly on like a really bad snow day. It's just that you have so many people that, you know, that the chance for something going wrong, if you don't have your attitude in check, is great. But in terms of being nice people, I think New Yorkers are the best.
Can I tell you one of my favorite Callahan cartoons?
Absolutely.
Okay, so Callahan, a late quadriplegic cartoonist, did this great cartoon that in New York, fuck you means have a nice day, and in L.A., have a nice day means fuck you.
Yeah, really? It's I actually... I haven't found the person yet. I mean, you have to know the person because, you know, fuck you to the right person is really, I really like you. And I feel so comfortable with you and so close to you that I could say that to you. You know, saying it to a stranger who doesn't know you, they themselves, especially if it's guys who need to, you know, defend their pride and see which ram has bigger horns, could turn into a fight.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's really true. So, again, you have to assess these people. But, you know, I really enjoy teasing. My boyfriend teases me all the time, and I see it as a form of affection.
Oh, no. My wife is Romanian, and the bottom line is that anything said with the right tone, it doesn't really matter. And she is more comfortable, which is interesting. If she's wearing something and I will critique it and say, you know what, that doesn't really do you the best, she's happier, much happier than if I say you look great. Because in her culture, the critique is really a form of protection, where just saying you look great is, in fact, you know, you don't really care.
But see, in fact, you have this advanced training. So, you know, there's that, you know, do I look fat in this dress? The losing question for guys. So not every man can be as successful as you at that.
Yeah, well, it's part of my charm and makes up for my poor eating habits. You know. Though I'll tell you, just a real quick story is that we went to this extremely expensive sushi place. And I, of course, doesn't matter, you know, my wife looks at me and she says, yeah, I know I'm not going to be able to tell you what to do because you're you. And I was eating with my hands the sushi, and the chef came around and he said, that's the way it's supposed to be eaten. And he comped our whole meal.
Oh, my God, that's so great. Yeah, no, I know that because I had a question about this for my column. This guy was licking his fingers, though, so that's the bad part. She didn't like he was eating with his hands. That actually seemed to be the right way. But licking your fingers,
Licking your fingers may be you know, much, and licking your partner's fingers even more so. So, yeah, you got to just keep the lines, you know, open. Amy, you were terrific. I so thank you for your time and your book, and we're going to promote it. Have your people tune in. You'll be up and running, I think, on Friday, and we'll send you, you know, copy. And this way everyone could hear you. And look forward, if I am ever in Venice, to, you know, to testing out some of the theories. And you could see, we could see how we both do it.
Right, no, I'm kidding. I said it's just down the street with my broom. But thank you. This was so great. You asked the most wonderful, smart questions. I love being on with you.
Thank you, Amy. You're terrific.
Thank you.
Bye. I want to once again thank Amy Alkin for coming onto our show. Pick up a copy of her book, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the Word Fuck. It's on Amazon.com, and visit AdviceGoddess.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Now, I'm your problem solver. If you have any problem of any kind, my specialty is executive life coaching, neuroplasticity, and you could call me at 212-599-3195, and you must visit my website, glucksolutions.com. Check out our other episodes at gluckradio.com. Also, visit my website at www.glucksolutions.com to learn more about clinical hypnosis and executive life coaching. Thank you for listening. Thank you for telling your friends. Till next time.